All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gym Fear 138 podcast. Today, I have, as my guest, this was kind of impromptu, Raul Nyanzi, author of Sword and Flower, who you can find at, it's just RaulNyanzi.com, right?
Correct.
Okay. And we were talking on Twitter today, which is the 31st, because J.D. Cohen, who unfortunately was not able to make it, I invited him, but he doesn't have a microphone, and I'm going to do my best to shame him into getting some kind of microphone so he can start appearing on these podcasts. he released a blog post that will be linked down in the description so people can follow along at home, but we all found it very interesting on Twitter. It generated this big, long discussion, and it's called The Death of the Genre Wars. And in this post, he kind of makes the point that genre, as we conceive it nowadays, isn't really as important as people like to make it out to be. Like, distinctions like science fiction and fantasy and hard science fiction and horror and things like that really don't matter. All that really matters, in his opinion, are action, adventure, romance, and suspense. So, Raul had gotten in touch with me. And he said that he wanted to talk about this, like, over Skype or something. And I was like, well, fuck it. You know, I'm doing the podcast tonight anyway. You want to just come on and we'll bullshit about it for however long? And so, yeah, here we are. So what do you think about this thing? And everybody at home, you might want to go ahead and just go read the thing. Like I say, it's linked down below. But just so you can get caught up with where we're at on this discussion.
Yeah, I read it. And it really did give me a whole lot to think about. Because... You see, when we tend to write these sorts of articles, we tend to, let's be honest, we tend to bitch and moan about the SJWs a lot.
We do. It's kind of sad, but it's an easy trap to fall into, honestly, because they're the ones who basically ruined everything, like back into like Campbell and all of that shit in the 40s. You know, so it's really easy to point at them and go, this is all your fault, you motherfuckers, but... it's a lot harder to do what JD did here and start working out proactive solutions.
This is rather true because one thing is I read this article and I came to a pretty sobering conclusion, one that's actually making me rethink my current novel project.
Really?
Oh yes. Yeah, I see that. This trend towards sociopolitical commentary has in many ways kicked out the wonderment from these genres. Mm-hmm. I mean, while I haven't been reading as much as I should, I do tend to see some mainstream TV from time to time, and you know, you're either getting, you know, the woke virtue signaling, or you're getting some reference to current politics or what have you, which is a major reason why I tend to flock to the Japanese media, namely the anime and the manga.
Yeah, I've had some experience with light novels, and it hasn't exactly been encouraging. But usually manga and anime are way better than like most cartoons and TV shows that are made in the West nowadays. And I'm not just saying that because I'm an unrepentant fucking weeaboo. The quality actually is a lot better. Like, when you look at superhero shows, like the shows that are going on Netflix, the Marvel shows, like The Punisher and Jessica Jones and Daredevil and things like that, and you see how just utterly depressing and nihilistic they are. And then you go and watch something like My Hero Academia, and it's just fun and hopeful and heroic, and it just understands heroism on a level that these Netflix shows fundamentally lack. Just at their core, they just don't have this thing that My Hero Academia does, and it's just a lot better quality in general.
And oh yes, it's strange that you bring up My Hero Academia, because there's something about it that I only noticed after watching a recent batch of episodes.
I'm not totally caught up, so.
No. This won't spoil anything.
I mean, I'm gonna watch it anyway, so it's not really a big deal.
If you've been watching the show, I'm sure you've seen this, but now I'm gonna point it out to you. It shows the consequences of violence. It shows the consequences of a violent lifestyle. And in spite of this, it retains its optimistic core.
So let's look at an incident that happened in season one, because I'm up to season two now. Most everybody who's familiar with the show has already seen season one. And even so, this won't be that big of a spoiler. Like when Eraserhead gets his ass beat, just pounded into the pavement trying to save these kids. You know, the next time he shows up in the show, he's got like broken arms and his face is smashed in, and he's just fucked. Like he's got serious injuries. Like he might not ever be able to see properly again, kind of shit.
Yeah. It's that, you know, he has to spend time recovering. He can't be as active as he used to be. You see in My Hero Academia, they constantly show the consequences of that lifestyle, yet they don't get cynical about it. And hell, even earlier than that, right there with All Might. Do you know why All Might is as sickly as he is?
He was injured in a battle with some villain, I think.
Exactly. He was injured in a battle.
That's a good point. I never thought about it like that.
Yes. Right from the start, they show you that...
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you're right. That was episode one where he pulled up his shirt and he's got this like gnarly fucking wound down his side. And he's explaining how he was injured in this battle and he can't be All Might for more than like an hour or two a day.
Yeah, and in spite of showing the cost of heroism, the cost of that kind of thing, it still remains optimistic about it. It still remains happy about it, still remains good about it. It still has that core, and that's just great because tying it back to JD's article, it's because it nonetheless embraces its escapist nature.
Yeah. And I mean, like, even talking about, like, breaking down genres and stuff like that, like, you look at the difference between MHA and, you know, Marvel Comics, for example. Every Marvel superhero has some kind of scientific explanation for their powers. They got it through some accident. It was radiation. It was something happened, and they have like a not scientifically accurate explanation for it, but they try to explain it through science. Meanwhile, you look at My Hero Academia and they're just like, yeah, this just started happening one day. We don't know why people have these quirks. It just kind of started happening. And now if you're missing this joint in your toe, you've got superpowers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that. Yeah. What I think it is that, well, I can only speak for myself, but I think that actually a lot of writers fall into this trap. It's that we get so obsessed with the concepts we come up with that we fail to realize most people aren't like that.
How do you mean?
Okay, we think of a cool concept for a story, and then we start just obsessing over its minutiae. So we put the minutiae in the story, thinking, you know, oh yeah, they'll love this. And then people aren't interested. Because...
Yeah, I get what you mean. It's like this post I wrote a while back, Pedantry Let's Kill Fantasy, where this guy went on this long Twitter rant about how is wheat domesticated in your fantasy universe? Where is your middle class? Where is your, you know, blah, blah, blah? Who makes this ale that they're drinking? How do they have ale in winter? You know, all of this kind of stuff that's just really not central to the plot of the story. Like, all of that stuff's good for world building. It's good for you as the author to know. But if it's not central to the story that you're telling, it doesn't need to be in there. At that point, it's just filler.
Yes. Like, for example, me and a friend of mine would often have some discussions about, you know, about the geopolitical implications of My Hero Academia's basic premise. But notice that stuff, you don't really see the political dimension expressed in the story. I mean, in My Hero Academia itself, not that we have any control over it, but, you know, notice that in the story itself, even though you would find yourself asking those questions, it's not addressed in story itself. In some ways, I actually kind of think that's better because it gives fans something to talk about.
Yeah, it leaves this level of mystery to it where we don't really know what's going on with that realm. So it's something that's interesting to theorize about and talk about, but it's not something that's ever specifically brought up in the show or in the manga. Whereas, like, you know, Marvel Comics, you've got Captain America punching out Hitler. Or more recent examples, you've got like the UN putting together superhuman divisions for their troops. What I don't remember what they're called. Or you've got the Superhuman Registration Act in the Civil War arc from Marvel. It's just this kind of focus on politics. And yeah, you can tell some really neat stories that way. Like, I liked Civil War for the most part, up until they picked a side at the end. But, you know, that's just not something that this show really concerns itself with. It's more concerned about, okay, there's people with superpowers, and we're going to play with them for as long as we can make this gimmick run for.
Yeah, and you notice a lot, it's not just My Hero Academia that does that. Even the more serious anime tend to do that. Notice that in pretty much any anime, even some of the more serious stuff like the various Gundam series, you don't see anything about some current day Japanese political controversy. For example, I've yet to see an anime that tackles their low birth rate head on, for just as an example.
Well, you might have that in Darling in the Franxx. I see a lot of people complaining about that being like right-wing propaganda trying to get Japan's population to fucking make babies again, but I honestly don't see it. Like you can read that into it, but I don't think that Studio Trigger specifically put that there. So I think that's more people projecting onto it than something that the show is actually doing.
And you bring up another good point. Even when you do see it, it's not in your face about it. There's still a sense of distance that allows anybody to enjoy the show.
Yeah, it's not like they put Trump's head on MODOK or something.
Yes, whereas in a lot of Western entertainment, it's very clear how you're supposed to feel.
Yeah. Yeah, they to preach at you.
Yeah, and that's generally what Cohen's article made me think of, because the other thing you notice is that, well, nobody, yeah, and as he makes and he makes this point, nobody cares about whether this is pure science fiction or pure fantasy or what have you. Nobody cares.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, maybe I'm drawing lines that don't exist here, but the opening of My Hero Academia, when they're quote-unquote explaining why all of these quirks came about and why people have superpowers, it reminds me a lot of the opening of Princess of Mars. And for those who haven't read the book, in Princess of Mars, John Carter is an ex-Confederate soldier who's riding through the desert, and he gets run up on by some Indians and driven into a cave, and he's shot. He's dying. And he walks out of the cave after the Indians run off, and he sees Mars overhead in the sky, and he stretches out his arms to it and basically wishes really hard, and then wakes up on Mars, and various adventures and hijinks ensue. And that's kind of how this feels with My Hero Academia. Like, we're going to have this little veneer of a scientific explanation over it, but it's not really that important, and it doesn't really explain anything. But it's a good enough springboard to get the actual story itself going.
And that's the other thing there. What matters most is the people involved.
Yeah, the characters are more important than why all of this is taking place.
Yeah, than all the little theorizing. And as I said, you know, it's probably better if all the theorizing, all the explanations are left to the fans, because, as I said, it gives them something to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, if everything's explained, it gets boring.
Yeah, and I think I saw that somewhere else as well. You know, having a bit of mystery is good in a story. Over-explaining everything isn't. I don't recall where I saw that, though.
It could have been anywhere. I mean, you know, we've all kind of belabored that point a lot, too. But to get back to, like, the genre mixing stuff.
Yes.
I think that JD has a serious point here with getting rid of, because a while back, a couple of years ago, I know you remember this, when Daddy Warpig lit everybody's hair on fire, when he was talking about how there's no real difference between fantasy and science fiction.
Oh, that.
Yeah. And it just kind of, the longer that I think about this, the more that I think that he was right. You know, like, what is faster than light travel? It's magic. It's something that we can't do. It might as well be magic. You know, magic can be high mathematics, like in The Dying Earth. that shit is magic in The Dying Earth. You know, the prismatic spray and all of these spells, they're magic, but they're based on ancient, forgotten mathematical formulas and ways of speaking and things that these people in this world don't understand, but it still works because it's basically ancient technology.
And also, yeah, which is why I kind of chuckled when I was watching the Black Panther movie and one character said, "This is not magic, this is science," when explaining the vibranium powered stuff.
I was
just shaking my head saying, no, that's magic. That might as well be magic. Because there's no substance we know of that behaves that way.
Mm-hmm. So for us, it's magic. You can class it as science fiction all you want, but like laser guns, spaceships like the Millennium Falcon, lightsabers, shit like that, we can't do that. So it might as well be magic. You know, you can try and pretend to have, they focus the light beam through these crystals and it comes out as this beam of plasma and shit. Okay, yeah, I get it. It's magic. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, you might as well, like the Force, you might as well be casting a fireball or something. You know, this might as well be Dragonlance.
Yes, and you have to consider, and that's why I think that sci-fi and fantasy really do just come down to a question of aesthetics. To the extent that science fiction exists at all, I would only say that the hard sci-fi, the one that really does try to adhere to currently understood science, can legitimately be called sci-fi as such. To the extent that we're making distinctions at all.
I mean, okay, toss me an example. Like, what do you mean? Because every piece of hard sci-fi that I've ever come in contact with has that bit of wonder. It's only like one or two things, but they always have that little grain of fantasy in there. That little bit of magic.
Haven't read or watched it, but The Martian is like the most obvious recent example.
Oh, okay. So, so far as I understand it, in The Martian, the guy is on Mars and he's trying to grow food in like hydroponics and things like that. Yeah, I guess that, because so far as I know, nothing actually fantastical, like everything that happens in The Martian could happen with technology that we have today, or that we would have in 5 years based on what we have now.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You know, it's based on currently understood science. Another one I'd say is hard sci-fi is something like Gattaca, which I've only seen part of.
I haven't watched Gattaca yet.
Yeah, that one's about, you know, using, you know, about, you know, at birth, people are tested genetically, and based on the makeup of their genes, they're like shunted into certain jobs.
Okay.
If someone is seen as somewhat genetically defective, they get the crap jobs, whereas people who are genetically good get better jobs, get better social positions, and also parents tend to, you know, choose genes for their babies that are desirable.
Oh, so like higher eugenics is a thing here. Like actual gene editing and stuff like that.
Yeah, things like that.
Okay.
But I'm saying that to the extent that we're making distinctions between sci-fi and fantasy at all, I'd only class hard sci-fi truly as sci-fi because it doesn't use some kind of fantastical hand wave for anything. It sticks rigidly to known science.
Yeah, I could honestly see that argument, but then, like on the other side, you're gonna have people who are mad because, you know, we don't have a definition for like pure fantasy. So as such, you know, like you were talking about with hard sci-fi being the only true science fiction because they don't actually hand wave it. What breaks down fantasy in that case? Like on the opposite end of that spectrum, insofar as you want to conceive it of it as a spectrum.
Well, I just see fantasy as anything that's not realistic based upon our current scientific understanding. Anything that's like that. I'm classing a lot of horror involving the paranormal. I'd call that a form of fantasy.
I would too, honestly.
Yeah. You know, of course, you know, the knights and castles and such that aren't strictly trying to be historically accurate. you know, things like that, you know, anytime anyone's casting a fireball. And yes, I will probably be savaged for this, but I'd class both Star Trek and Star Wars as fantasy.
Oh, of course they are. I mean, especially in Star Wars. This is one of the things that I really like that they did about Galaxy's Edge, because in Star Wars, they had to fuck it up. George Lucas had to fuck it up in the prequel trilogy by bringing the whole midichlorian explanation into it. But in Galaxy's Edge, now I've only read the first book, but my brother is current on the series and he never shuts the fuck up about it. apparently in Galaxy's Edge, when they finally get into the whole, you know, space wizards and space magic and shit like the Force and stuff, they don't fuck around with that shit. No, it's not magical little microbes in your bloodstream that give you the power to kill people from miles and miles away. It's legit fucking magic. It is, and the guy calls himself a space wizard. You know, that they just don't play around with that kind of bullshit at all. And I cannot wait to get into the rest of that series and get up to that point, because that's what I remember the old Star Wars being. Just not fucking around with any of the scientific explanation for the blasters worked, the ships flew through space like that, you don't need to know why. Yes, if physics actually worked like that, nobody would be able to exist in the universe, but nobody fucking cares because the story is cool.
Yeah, what matters more than scientific explanations, I find, is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that you need a scientific explanation for everything. It's more that you need everything, you know, you need to obey the rules you yourself set down in the story.
Right.
Or that the, you know, the story needs to obey its own rules, rather. You know, just that, you know, if punching a crystal means that your hand explodes, it must happen every time. And if it doesn't happen, you know, you need some kind of explanation for why that didn't happen that time. Just as an example.
Right. No, I gotcha. And then, like you'd mentioned Star Trek, just to kind of play people off with it, no, Star Trek is fantasy. Get over it.
Oh, yeah. It's every bit as fantasy as Star Wars, in my opinion.
You know, all the Roddenberry fans out there, Q uses magic. Get over it.
Yeah. Warp drive is magic. Get over it.
Yeah, there's no breaking it down here. You know, there's no saving that. Which I honestly think that finally admitting that science fiction and fantasy are essentially the same genre, unless you're strictly not introducing some kind of advanced technology in the case of fantasy, or zero magic in the case of science fiction. If it's not one of those two extremes, like, for example, Lord of the Rings, I would class as pure fantasy, because it doesn't have that high technology stuff. Nobody's running around with like steampunk technology and shit like that. You know, their siege engines are big towers and battering rams and giant creatures like the Oliphants and stuff like that. There's no like guns, there's no flintlock pistols or anything. You know,
there are things like spirits and magic as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, and of course species that don't exist in real life.
Which is another thing that I'm glad that you brought up, because that's another distinction between fantasy and science fiction that I don't understand. Let's take Mass Effect for an example. Did you play Mass Effect?
No, 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 no.
The first one is really good. After that, the series has a sharp drop-off in quality.
Look, let me tell you. I generally do not like the aesthetics of most Western games. Just putting that out there. Continue.
That's fair. You know what the Asari are, right?
I know that.
Blue alien women who live for hundreds or thousands of years in some cases. They have this kind of aura about them. They can communicate telepathically with people. They can bond telepathically with people. And they can reproduce with any race in the universe just because that's how their DNA works. How are they not elves? Because they have tentacles on their heads? Like, what's the difference between that and an elf?
No difference at all. But aesthetics.
Yeah, it's basically the aesthetics. Or like the Krogan. You know, the big turtle frog monsters. How are they different from, say, orcs? You know, they're very warlike race. They're not interested in high technology. They're not interested in philosophy. They just want to kill shit. Except for the aesthetics, except for the skin that you put over them. Like, you know, you can reskin models in a video game. Except for that shit, they might as well just be space orcs.
Yeah. It also brings to mind stuff like the Kryptonians, who look like humans. Except if you bring one to Earth, they suddenly become super strong.
Yeah.
And that's what I said, if you bring one to Earth. On their own planet, they're just normal.
Yeah, they're functionally human on Krypton, but you put one under a yellow sun and all of a sudden, Superman.
You get super whatever. And likewise, the Saiyans, they have tails and they turn into giant apes at the sight of the full moon. And they can also turn into golden-haired killing machines. I know you don't watch Dragon Ball. I forgot.
Oh, no, dude. I love Dragon Ball. I've seen...
No, wait. Who was the one who didn't like it, though?
It wasn't me. No, I used to watch that shit every day in middle school, man. I'd come home and catch Toonami every afternoon.
Oh, man, I apologize. I must be thinking about somebody else. I'm sorry.
It's cool. But yeah, like, and Dragon Ball Z, that's another perfect example. What do you class Dragon Ball Z as?
That is fantasy straight up.
Like, they have, like, the Kai powers and everything like that, and they can turn into more powerful versions of themselves, and they can move so fast just under their own power that, you know, you can't follow their movements. But they also go to alien planets, and, like, the Saiyans are an alien race, and, like, the Namekians and shit like that. So it weaves in this aura of the mystical and the spiritual with this science fiction thing, and it does it so effortlessly. You cannot classify Dragon Ball Z as fantasy or science fiction in the way that people who are stocking bookstore shelves traditionally understand it.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it has the sci-fi elements as traditionally understood, but also the fantasy elements. And then you also have to remember that whole, you know, Dragon Ball was for the most part improvised.
Really?
Why do you think the enemies kept changing during the Android saga?
See, this is one of the areas that, because I haven't seen the entirety of DBZ, because it's like fucking 15 seasons. I saw all of Dragon Ball, but I think I watched most of the Buu saga, and I've seen the entire Saiyan saga and the Namek saga. And then like a smattering of episodes in between those. So I've seen like the most of the beginning and like the very end. You know, before GT came out and that whole thing happened.
All this dead air is not good.
Oh, don't worry. That's why I record on the back end, so I can cut it out. But yeah, it's just like, and DBZ was one of the most popular shows, period, in America and Japan for like 10 years.
This is true.
Just like a ridiculous fucking... Like, there's a reason that Toonami would not only play the show back to front for as long as they could possibly get away with it, but then they would play, you know, reruns of the show. They would syndicate it all the time. Like, I can't count how many times I've seen the Saiyan saga.
I know. Yeah, it's like a friend of mine put it this way, that Dragon Ball Z is the nexus of anime.
Hmm.
Yeah, because he's pointing out that it had such a strong influence on anime going forward. Stuff like Naruto was directly inspired by it.
That's fair. I mean, I haven't watched Naruto because I have taste, but...
Understand. I understand. I mean, I liked Naruto, especially in its early seasons, but I just kind of dropped off from the later seasons because life happened. However, that one is broadly speaking falls more on the fantasy end than the sci-fi end, but there are some sci-fi elements.
So what you're saying is it's a spectrum.
But I largely agree with JD in that, you know, I generally believe that most stuff we typically think of as science fiction is actually fantasy.
I don't know if I would go so far as that. See, I'm just like, I just heard your idea about the only real science fiction is the hardest of the hard sci-fi. And I kind of like that idea, but at the same time, I think that sci-fi is a useful aesthetic to have around. Just in terms of, you know, okay, we're in space now. All right, this isn't, you know, something like Spelljammer. Are you familiar with Spelljammer?
I've only heard the name once. I'm not familiar.
Spelljammer was a kind of splinter of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons back in, I want to say, the late 80s and the early 90s. But it was basically DBZ in space. And they came up with a whole bunch of other races and things like this for Spelljammer. But at its core, it still had, like, the magic, but you also had, like, spaceships and blaster rifles and, you know, very Star Wars-influenced kind of tabletop role-playing game. So it's obviously got a lot of what we traditionally consider to be science fiction influence here, which I guess is traditionally understood as extremely high technology that might as well be magic, and generally some kind of space travel going on.
I agree. The sci-fi aesthetic, yes, I do believe that distinction does have to be made between the fantasy aesthetic, which tends toward older style, which tends toward, you know, creating older style societies, recreating ancient or medieval society, versus the sci-fi aesthetic, which is meant to portray an imagined future or a lot of high technology. You know, something, you know, both of those are meant to give you a different feel.
Yeah, a very, very different feel. But I've honestly, and the thing that's really brought me around to this was reading stuff like A Princess of Mars and Planet of Adventure and a couple of other books. It really is a lot more effective of a storytelling medium, I guess, when you combine them. When you just, like, don't worry about all this fancy having to have a scientific explanation for everything in your story, and you just, okay, we've got spaceships, and we've got aliens, and we've got, you know, magic, and all of this stuff. Like, the story that I just finished posting today, Magic from the Sky, I specifically made a point that, you know, the tooth that the guy brings out of the pirate ship is not understood by science. Like, there's an entire guild, the Technomancer's Guild, that is devoted to understanding these things, and we just use them to power machinery because we can draw power from. They have this power inherent into them that we don't understand how it got there or why it's there, but we can use it to make our toasters go. Or when the salamander chick throws a fireball and it starts melting this mech like it's napalm or something.
You know,
I specifically include that kind of stuff in the science fiction stories that I write because it's just so much more fun when you mix magic and mechs.
I agree. You know, the anime Escaflowne, for example, mixes the medieval European fantasy with mechs.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through that one at this
point. I have not fully watched that show. I'm going to start it over from the top sometime later. But
it's,
I have not.
It's really
I've not. I know that. I told you. I've watched quite a lot of the show, but not all of it.
Yeah. I just had a bunch of people recently telling me that, oh, no, you need to go watch Escaflowne. You need to get... Now, and they would always temper it with, it's not as cool as it sounds. You know, it's not that great of a show, but it's like, you know, 90s anime bedrock kind of stuff. Like, you need to watch this. If you watched Cowboy Bebop and you watched Trigun and you watched Fooly Cooly and, you know, you watched Evangelion, you need to watch Escaflowne. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna go watch Escaflowne.
And
I start watching that thing and I'm just like fucking amazed at how goddamn cool this show is.
Yes. And that brings me to something else I want to talk about too. Are you familiar with the isekai genre? Benjamin Chia, you know, brought it up a few times before.
For those of you in the audience that don't know, isekai is a Japanese word that means another world. And basically, it's a genre of literature that's kind of taken over the market in Japan at this point, about a mundane character, like a normal human guy, being transported to another world that's most... Usually it follows video game rules if it's not outright a video game. So something like Overlord or Konosuba or
Sword Art Online.
Sword Art Online is another example. Not a very good example, but another example.
Yeah, but it tended to it popularized it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I bring that up because, you see, before Sword Art Online and all the stuff that was modeled after it, isekai were very, 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 very different. Let me explain. You see, before Sword Art Online and such, the typical isekai tended to have a female protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
However, don't roll your eyes because she wanted to marry Sue. Quite the opposite, in fact. She was usually out of her depth in the New World.
Yeah, like Escaflowne is an example of that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm driving at. Yeah, she's kind of out of her depth in this New World, and then she has to, and then she usually hooks up with a guy. And then she has to kind of figure things out. The guy does most of the fighting, but while she assists him, but you know, as time goes on, she becomes more confident and more, you know, and more able in that new world as she connects with the guy a bit closer. So it's closely tied with romance as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a good example of old school isekai that I'm sure a lot of people have seen is Inuyasha.
Yes, Inuyasha is a great show. Fuck anybody who says otherwise.
Yes, it is an excellent show and an excellent example of the genre I'm talking about.
Yeah, but over the course of the show, Kagome becomes more competent with the bow, and she deals with this love triangle between Inuyasha and I cannot remember the priestess lady's name.
Kikyo,
that was it. Yeah, Kikyo. She deals with this love triangle between Inuyasha and Kikyo, and there were a lot of really heavy romance subplots in that show. But at the end of the day, just about every episode, Inuyasha was going to fight somebody.
Oh, yes. And he fought well. Yeah, and that's how isekai, and what you saw in Inuyasha was generally typical of isekai. For a long time. Then Sword Art Online came along and the trend started going toward male protagonists who were overpowered and would get harems.
Mm.
Yeah, I haven't seen as many recent as many of the more recent style of isekai, although I would have to say Gates is absolutely one of the worst examples, in my opinion, of this.
Gate is the one where
the Japanese military goes into the fantasy world and starts kicking everybody's ass.
Yeah, that's the one. Like, they have dragons fighting F-14 fighter planes and shit like that, and it's not
as cool as it sounds, honestly.
It sounds really cool. Like, how do you fuck that up?
They did, trust me, they did.
I'm going to have to go and watch this show just to figure out how you can fuck up a premise that cool. Because I honestly don't understand how you do it.
Well, it's very easy how you do it. Just don't challenge them.
Oh, so, I remember hearing that was one of the problems with Gate was that the Japanese military just kind of rolls over the medieval fantasy armies and stuff.
Yeah, and the medieval fantasy guys never freaking get a clue.
I think, honestly, that's one of the reasons that I like Konosuba so much, is because it's intentionally played for laughs, like, the incredibly vast majority of the time. That show is a comedy. But it takes these tropes that you're talking about, and I know this is a dirty word here, but in this case I think it's justified, and it subverts them, because the guy comes into the world, and he knows jack shit. And Jack left town. He doesn't know anything about this world, he doesn't have any special powers. He's not even that extraordinary. So he decides to learn to be a rogue. And meanwhile, the chick who has all of the powers, Aqua, is a literal goddess. She's got this ridiculously high wisdom or whatever it is. So she can become an archpriest right off the bat. She's just extraordinarily powerful right out the gate. But she's an idiot. So she's not able to use her powers to full effectiveness. And then he gathers around this harem of girls that just, like, kind of hate him. Because he's a weird, creepy, you know, kind of a lech. And they don't think that that's, like, normal. That's not, like, an endearing trait in in the main character.
Oh yeah, I recall where I got the impression that isekai were not very good, that the recent kind of isekai were not very good. It's because I tried light novels multiple times and was, yeah, especially these isekai light novels, you know?
Yeah, like
I tried them multiple times and I was consistently disappointed.
Yeah, like I've been reading, I still haven't made it through. Like the Konosuba light novel is about as wide as your thumb. It's not very big at all. The first one is, at least. And it's just bad. It's so badly written. I cannot make my... I finished, like, three other novels while I was reading that.
I could not finish any of the light novels I've bought. I could not finish any of them. They're that badly written.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's just, like, the translation. But at the same time, I've read translations from, like, Japan and Russia and things like... Like, the translation of Metro 2033 is fucking exquisite. The translation of Vampire Hunter D is just balls out fucking incredible. It is so good.
So, yeah, I mean, I've read a translated Japanese book too.
They really don't have any excuse to be as bad as they are.
I really do think it's that the writing is very much subpar. Yeah, but then we're going off on this tangent about isekai because, well, my own book is an isekai.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Sword and Flower?
Yes.
Yeah,
my own book is an isekai. But you'll notice when you read it that it follows the model, you know, follows the Inuyasha model, not the Sword Art Online model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it very much does. I think that's why it entertained me more than, like, the Konosuba light novel did.
Yeah, and I'm not some big name either. And if even some random Black American guy can write better than you all, than, you know, these other people, well, I mean, what does that say about them as authors? Yet, at the same time, they sell pretty well. In Japan, at least.
Yeah. Which I think might be because it plays to the escapism thing. It might also have to do with, you know, the novel being written in its native language is always going to be more effective than the novel translated into another language. But it might have something to do with just the sheer level of escapism. Because, like, the problem with Japan and their focus on studying and work and not having a home life, essentially, is overblown, but it's not inaccurate. So a lot of guys, specifically guys, who are thrust into that kind of thing want some damn kind of outlet. And these isekai novels, badly written or not, give it to them. And now that I'm thinking about it, this sounds a lot like the pulps back in, like, the 20s and the 30s and shit like that. Like, the 20s, the Great Depression was going on. You still had all of these pulp magazines going around, like Weird Tales and Argosy and shit like that, and detective stories and various
others. Oh yeah, so I've actually read some of those.
These gave those guys some kind of escapism, and they were wildly fucking popular, just like the isekai novels in Japan are today.
That's true. Very true. That's very true, and I think it's a very good comparison. It also shows that, you know, style as such, it may not be as important as you think. Mind you, that doesn't mean I'll slack on my prose. That just means that, you know, you don't have to be some stylish maestro to entertain people.
Right. You don't have to be, you know, the Bach of the written word to make your stories entertaining.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Again, as I'm saying, you know, that doesn't mean you don't write well. That just means, you know, you don't panic so much that your words aren't perfectly on point.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I take from it. That's what I take from it, at least. Yet I still manage to kind of panic about how I write.
I mean, I do too. It's just like with this whole, like, trying to put out a story a week on Steemit, and I'm doing other stuff that we're going to be releasing on Amazon that's going to be Amazon exclusive. But so far as, like, you know, I'll go and reread, like, I was rereading the story that's coming out in Kirsova tomorrow, and it looks really good in the PDF that Alexander gave me, but you know, I'm reading it and I'm like plastered at this point. I got this email at like fucking 4 a.m. or something, and I was already on a bender. And I'm just rereading it, and I'm like, there's so much in here that I would have changed to just tighten up the prose and use different words in places and avoid echo words and shit like that. But at the end of the day, I'm happy with how that story came out. You know, I put these stories up on Steemit and shit like that, and I go through and I read them later, like weeks and weeks after they've been published. And then I'm like, oh God, I fucked up there. I didn't use the right word here, or I could have tightened that phrase up a little bit. But what matters more than me getting the story perfect is me getting the story good enough for people to enjoy.
Yes. And sometimes when I look at Sword and Flower, when I reread it, I do kind of cringe at some of the word choices I made. And, you know, unlike these Japanese guys who are selling their books and getting anime made of their books, God, I'm so jealous.
you and me both.
Yeah. But, I mean, unlike those guys who are selling well, I mean... Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly killing it on Amazon, but you know, but nonetheless, I'm still proud of what I wrote, even if, as you said, I'm not the Bach of the written word.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, is that you also have to take into account the differences in the publishing market in Japan and the publishing market in the U.S. Because if you're not part of the Big Five, and you don't have a huge social media following, or you're not one of those set-up guys like Larry Correa who worked to get as set-up as he is, you're unknown. Nobody's going to buy your shit. Unless it's just, like, curiosity buys. Like, that's one of the problems, quote-unquote, with Amazon's algorithms, is that, you know, if you avoid, like, ghettoization, like the Castalia House ghetto and things like that, then you will get brought up in, like, somebody buys an isekai novel, right? And then they see, oh, Sword and Flower. Okay, well, this is an isekai, and it's got a cool cover. I might like this. I'll pick that up, too. And then they go and read it, and they might buy your next thing. They might not, but that's kind of how the algorithm works. It recommends things in people's reading habits, or at least in their buying habits.
It goes off of sales history, as Nick Cole said.
Right, but if you're completely unknown, then... You know, the best you can kind of hope for is to game the algorithm in your favor and then hope that you'll get a following out of that. Or if you've actually got a relatively large online following, then you can be reasonably sure of sales and word of mouth to carry your, you know, the algorithm and word of mouth to carry your sales forward. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that it's just about not banging the drum, but I mean, that definitely comes into play here. But I think it's just about writing stories to entertain people. And I know that I've gotten some heat from like Jesse Abraham Lucas and a couple of other people about, you know, just saying entertain people doesn't really explain anything. But what I mean by that is, like, if you're writing with an ulterior motive, then your stories are not going to be as good as somebody who's writing strictly to entertain. Like, there are stories that win Hugo Awards that I wouldn't touch in a million years. But there are stories in, like, the Pulp Rev sampler, which Jesse even admits was unevenly edited and doesn't have the best quality fiction in the world. I would still read those stories over the shit that's winning Hugo's nowadays, because those stories are there specifically to entertain me. There's no ulterior motive. There's no, you know, political posturing. There's no preaching. There's no none of that. It's just, you know, hey, I wrote this story about a guy fist fighting aliens on a spaceship.
Yeah, and I wrote my story about a Japanese pop star teaming up with a Puritan to fight a demon.
Yeah, and
like, how the hell does that even work? You know?
Exactly, and that kind of stuff is, I think, you know, more entertaining because A, it's outlandish, and B, you guys aren't trying to preach some kind of message at me. You know, I know that if I come to this story, I'm just going to be asked to forget the real world for however long it takes me to read it and just suspend my disbelief and enjoy the story.
Yes. Although if you do want to get kind of socio-political, I did notice this sometime after I'd published the book. My novella, turns the white savior narrative completely on its head.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Think about it. Okay. Think of, okay. Think of, yeah. think of Yeah, think of the archetype.
That just fucking hit me. A black guy turning the white savior narrative on its head. That's gorgeous.
Yeah, all right. For example, think about it. Think about the archetype for the sort of story Sword and Flower is. Not just the Inuyasha style archetype, but also what's going on in there.
Yeah.
You see, it's basically like Dances with Wolves, or more recently, James Cameron's Avatar. Mm. You know, you have The Last Samurai. That's another good one in this genre. Yeah, you have the white male hero, usually European or American or whatever, go into like a tribe of primitive but spiritual people, and then he learns their ways, gets acclimated to them and such, but then he has to defend these people from an invader from his own culture. And in doing so, and he successfully defeats the invader, or at least he survives the battle, and then stays with the spiritual but primitive people. But what I do in Sword and Flower, though, is instead of the white male hero, you have an Asian female.
Yeah.
And in this case, the spiritual but primitive people aren't some tribe somewhere. Somewhere in Africa or somewhere in some far off corner of the world, but they are the Puritans.
In this, magical, mystical, spiritual world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And not like a world that has, magical, mystical spiritualism in it. This is the literal, no shit, after death spirit world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the lesser heaven, a kind of purgatory. Yeah, the spiritual but primitive people we're dealing with here are the Puritans. And you notice I even have the enemy from her own culture that is menacing them.
Oh man, it's been a while since I read it.
It's like a banker she meets in chapter 2.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, I gotcha.
You even have that aspect. And here's the thing, when I was writing the story, I wasn't thinking about that at all.
Yeah, I was about to ask you about that, if you had, any ideas about turning the white savior narrative on its head, or playing with these tropes, or anything like that. It was an instinctual writing process.
Yes, it's like, I wasn't thinking about white savior anything when I was writing it. I just wanted to write a story about a pop star and a Puritan.
Yeah, it's like this Larry Correa thing that you linked me earlier on Twitter.
Oh yeah, Correa on the classics. You should link that whenever you put this podcast up or whatever.
I will, because there's one there's one specific part that I wanted to touch on, and you just gave me the perfect opportunity, so I'm gonna touch it. Maybe bad touch, but. Let me see here. There was a certain. Let me get. Okay, so this is the rant. Where was the true story part? There. Oh God, no! I remember reading this. The shit was so good because it just completely encapsulated the difference between, the literary set and. Like the pulp author, like Larry Correa is. It was the "what does it mean" thing. Maybe it was in the rant.
Oh yeah, hang on.
I got it.
Yeah.
So, true story. A friend of mine is a successful fantasy novelist. He was asked to speak to a creative writing class about his first book. The teacher asked him what it quote unquote meant. He gave her the plot synopsis. No, what does it quote unquote mean? It is a fantasy about magic, and no, what is the real meaning? You see, college English is the only place where Freudian psychology is still legitimate. Everything has to have a deeper meaning. A book can't just be a story. It has to be an analogy for some social commentary. And heaven help us if it wasn't, because then all those no-talent hack English professors wouldn't be able to write 1,000-page commentaries on what the whale and Moby Dick really represented. Just boom, there you go. Your story, Sword and Flower, was written to be a fun story to read.
Yes.
You know, all of this white savior stuff is something that is read, that you're the author and you're literally reading that into it when it does not exist in the story itself as you wrote it.
Yeah, I know. I noticed it like sometime after I had published it. I mean, I don't think it's a lesser story for having that subtext. It's just, you know, it's best when if you're going to have that kind of theme at all, it's best if it just springs up organically rather than you trying to make that point.
Right, that it's an instinctual thing. You know, I'm reading this biography of Robert E. Howard that, no, I will never shut the fuck up about, Blood and Thunder. And the guy who's writing the biography itself, don't be thrown by the introduction if you go and pick up Blood and Thunder. The guy who wrote the introduction, Lansdale, is like one of those snooty English teacher types. But Mark Finn, the guy who wrote the book, he talks a lot about Howard's instinctual writing process. How Howard would go and read history, like the Picts in lots of Howard's stories, like Bran MacMorn's people. He read a book on English history when he was a little kid, like maybe 15 or under. And he found out about the Picts, and they were this, you know, really trodden upon, low tech, not very kind of advanced in anything, savages, basically. And they never amounted to anything in British history. They were quickly conquered and wiped out. But Howard took a liking to them because he likes underdog story, or he liked underdog stories. And he was like, these are my people now. You know, these are the people I'm going to try and give them a good run of things. I'm going to turn them into warlike, strong barbarians, and I'm going to give them a great king in Bran MacMorn. And then, you know, all of the stuff with Bran MacMorn and the Picts that shows up in his stories is kind of an outgrowth of his love of underdogs and wanting to give the underdogs a chance to shine. Now, the Picts are always on the losing end. Civilization always rolls over them. They're going to lose at the end of this great saga, but he gave them a more heroic saga than they could have. Or with, like, the Conan stories. There's a lot in the Conan stories that's like, you know, he didn't put that there intentionally. You know, when he was sitting at his typewriter, he wasn't thinking, oh, this will be monstrously clever of me to include this particular thing. You know, no, he just kind of did it. And then everybody reading the books 100 years later is like, oh, wow, let's dissect the subtext of Robert E. Howard and decide what a fucking racist he was.
A lot of those pulp authors were just trying to write something to pay the bills, or maybe they just thought the story is good and I'm going to write it.
Exactly. Like Walter B. Gibson. You know, this is the guy who wrote so much that he had to be, I've told this story before, but he had to be hospitalized. His wife had to forcibly restrain him and take him to the hospital because he was writing so many shadow stories that his fingers had broken on his typewriter.
Typewriters. Yeah, that's like resistance training for writers.
Pretty much. But, like, you can't sit here and fucking tell me that this guy was writing so much that his fingers broke. We're talking, like, 12 plus hours a day just sitting at your typewriter writing, only taking breaks to go to the bathroom and eat food and sleep. You can't tell me that this motherfucker who was trying to pay the bills with his writing was, like, trying to insert all of this subtext and grand themes and bullshit like that, despite the fact that if you look at The Shadow and you look at the vast majority of the Shadow Tales, The Shadow has a severe objectivist morality. And, you know, you can read all of this stuff into how The Shadow dealt with his foes and the criminals that he ran up against. You can read all of that stuff in, but you can't tell me that Walter B. Gibson was trying to make a grand commentary on objective morality back when he was trying to pay bills with these stories. He was writing to entertain people.
Yes, and as you pointed out, as I believe you or somebody else or something pointed out, The Shadow was a legit phenomenon back in its day.
I think that was Razor Fist that pointed that one out.
It was him.
I've repeated it, but I got it from Razor Fist, so credit where it's due.
Yeah, it's that The Shadow was a legit phenomenon back in its day. So he had a good run of it, and indeed, someone like him is an inspiration to us all. Oh, someone like Walter B. Gibson, I mean, literally breaking your fingers. Yeah. Is an inspiration to us all. I mean, with our fancy computer keyboards, we don't even compare.
I will admit that I get finger pains because I hit the keys too hard, but it's nothing like what Gibson went through.
And I've annoyed quite a few people around me when I hit the keys of my own keyboard very hard.
Oh, I got one of those nice clacky keyboards.
Same here. I primarily draft my stories on a Neo 2. It's discontinued. It was originally intended for the education market, but then iPads came along, so they became old hat.
Yeah. JD makes this interesting point about the advertisement and how, you know, the literary set and the people who get all intellectual and up in themselves about literature just don't understand what was so appealing about something like the pulps. In this little paragraph here, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and read it.
Go ahead.
There were no advertisements discussing the finer points of the feudal system and how it benefits the monarchy and how the audience needs to know this, or propaganda about how amazing science is in exchange for any entertainment. In other words, these stories were not advertised as fantasy or science fiction. The mainstream audience didn't care that much about them. These were advertised as breathtaking adventures meant to wow the reader and make them pick up the issue based on the incredible sights before them. They used wonder for the selling point of accessing the reader's imagination, and not the nuts and bolts aesthetics that only the 1% of the 1% care about. The genres back then were not as we know them now.
That really did give me some food for thought. You know, and it goes back to something we said way back earlier, that we like to become obsessed with our own creations. We, you know, with all the minutiae about how it works. I mean, it's interesting to us because we thought of it, but to the casual average reader, not so much.
Yeah, like the average person watching Escaflowne does not care how the mechs work.
Exactly.
All that matters is that they do.
Yeah, the average person watching Naruto does not care how they run that fast jumping through trees or how, and they sure as hell don't care about Hidden Leaf Village's tax policy.
But I think JD is striking at a deeper point with the method of writing here. These stories were not advertised as fantasy or science fiction. They weren't written that way either, I don't think. Like, when you read H.P. Lovecraft, do you class that as fantasy or horror or science fiction? Most people would class it as horror, but when you look at something like At the Mountains of Madness, we're talking about beings that came down from the stars thousands of years ago and literally terraformed Earth. They created mankind through scientific experiments. That sounds like science fiction to me.
Yes.
You know, and, or when he makes references, because technically, the stories of Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft take place in the same universe, because H.P. Lovecraft does this cool little trick where he mentions Hyperborea, I think he called it, or Hyboria, which is basically, you know, Robert E. Howard's Conan world. You know, so with connections back to that, is this fantasy? You know, with this mythical history of the Earth that he's drawing upon, that these two guys created in their fucking bedroom sitting at their typewriters, is this fantasy? Is it science fiction with the beings coming down from the stars? Is it horror with the, you know, obvious horrific elements going on within the story? You cannot place it. And that's what makes those stories so good, and that's why they have endured for so long, is that you cannot fucking pin them down.
Yes, that's perhaps what makes them interesting to read too. I haven't read any Lovecraft because, you know, well, horror isn't my thing.
That's fair enough. I would recommend reading Lovecraft, just because, in my opinion, he's the best author in the horror genre, quote unquote, that America ever produced. But you know, some people have problems with him because he was racist, and he was, but he recanted those views at the end of his life and even put that into a few of his stories, like in At the Mountains of Madness. There's one particularly heartfelt line where he's talking about the elder things, the beings that came down from the stars and terraformed Earth. And, you know, they dug them up out of the ice and they thawed them out and they were still alive. So they ran through this old city that they used to live in that's now ruins. And they're trying to understand how the world around them works. And they get killed by the Shoggoth. And there's one line where he says something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, you know, whatever they were men. This scientist who's come down to Antarctica to plumb the mysteries of the frozen South feels this kinship with these alien beings that he's never known and could never understand their method of thought or way of life. He feels this kinship with them because they were trying to scientifically understand the world around them the same way he does at the end of the story. So, you know, not all of Lovecraft is, oh my god, miscegenation is bad. it's not all Shadow over Innsmouth kind of stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I consider, like, yeah, it's like when I went back and was reading the Appendix N stuff, I do admit I've been neglecting that for some time now because I've been trying to write my own stuff for a while.
I think a lot of us are in that boat, quite frankly.
I went back and read a lot of those old Appendix N stories, and yeah, I can see what would give modern critics. Note, I didn't say modern audiences. I said modern critics.
Because there's a very big difference.
Big, huge difference. Yeah. For example, look at The Last Jedi on Rotten Tomatoes. But enough quipping.
Okay, a better example, Bright. Did you watch Bright?
That too. Hadn't watched Bright, but yeah, I'd heard that one had a huge critic audience split as well.
Oh man, it was like the audience was at like 85%, the critics were at like 25%. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, but as I was saying, you know, getting back to Appendix N, you know, it contained a lot of things that I know modern critics don't like, but you know, but all in all, those stories aren't so awful. You know, aren't so awful that I wouldn't give it to, like, my little cousin to read. Things like that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the usual contention that you hear with the Appendix N books, or even the pulps in general, is that, oh, it's misogynistic and it's racist and, you know, it's sexist or whatever. But back when these stories were being published, like, you're trying to apply, like, you might as well try to apply modern morality to Genghis Khan.
Yeah,
it just doesn't function like that. These stories were written in a different time, and I don't think they were written for a different audience, to be quite honest. I think if the vast majority of people in America decided to just go and read the pulps, they would be just as enamored with them as people in the pulp rev are, because they would realize that these stories are trying to speak to them. This is working class fiction. This is something that's meant to take them out of the drudgery of their everyday life. And yes, it has probably like Black Canaan by Robert E. Howard, who, you know, is like my god, essentially. You know, Black Canaan has more uses of the word nigger than I have ever heard in a story in my entire life.
Ah.
I mean, it's fucking everywhere in that story. But at the same time, the main character doesn't look down on the black people. He just kind of uses it because everybody else is using it. It's a really weird story. It's good. I would recommend reading it, but like it would definitely offend the sensibilities of the modern day literati, which is why, you know, you kind of have to take the time that Howard was writing in and what was going on in Texas at the time into account when you read the story. And it doesn't excuse it, but it explains it. But I'm not going to make excuses for Robert Howard because, you know, I love the guy's fiction.
Yeah, and that reminds me as well of another one of the Appendix N books I read, At the Earth's Core. It's by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Oh, you know, man, I want to read that so badly.
It's about a guy named David Innes who goes down to the center of the Earth, where he discovers this whole primitive, like, Stone Age era. It's kind of like the Stone Age down there.
Yeah. Yeah, like Marvel Savage Land kind of stuff.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, ruled over by lizard-like beings called Mehars.
Ooh, I've got to. You fucking got me, fam. That's next on my reading list.
Yeah, At the Earth's Core. I reviewed it on my site a while back.
Link me to the review, and I'll post it in the description. I would honestly like to read it because I'm definitely going. You fucking had me at lizard people, dude.
Yeah, you see. Yeah, you see. All right. Yeah. What, as I said in the review, and this won't be anything spoilerish. Like, that being said, one thing bears mentioning. It is abundantly clear that this book was written well before World War II and the cultural changes it heralded. Eugenics is mentioned in a positive light. David shows great pride in the achievements of his civilization back in the surface, with no hint of cynicism beyond thinking that maybe humanity has gone a bit soft. He makes observations about race that, while not malicious, are politically incorrect to 21st century ears. Perry matter-of-factly states that the Mehars are superior and that it is their right to rule Pellucidar due to their much higher intelligence. Humans are little more than dogs compared to them.
That's fucking crazy. I really, really need to go and read this before I write the rest of my Dirk Cooper stories, because, like, that's one of the things that I'm doing with that, is the guy goes to Venus and he crash lands and he finds out that, oh my god, it's a forest planet, there's dinosaurs and there's lizard men that have enslaved the local population, and they treat them little better than dogs. You know, they're slaves, they're a food source, and this guy kind of allies with the humans because they find him first. They save his life. And, like, the overarching storyline is going to be, like, him trying to help the humans free themselves from the Reptoids. But, you know, given that description that you just laid out, I think I really need to go and read this book.
You should, because really it was a window into, like, a totally different world. I think the story was published even before World War I really happened.
Yeah, actually, like, let me look that up. You can go ahead and keep talking. I'm just gonna.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, it was published, you know, before all those cultural changes sunk in. The cultural changes caused by World War I. You know, because you know, it's that time where Western civilization started saying, you know, maybe we're not so great.
This was 1915 when this was published.
Yeah, so World War I was happening.
Yeah, it was in the throes of World War I.
Yeah, America wasn't in it yet, but it was happening.
I think in 1915 it was kind of winding down, wasn't it?
No. 1918 is generally accepted as the end, and that's also the time where America jumped in on the tail end.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're right.
But, I mean, World War I, you know, again, you know, the cultural changes heralded by World War I had not yet sunk in at the time. So, yeah, so it really is a window into a completely different way of thinking. And indeed, you know, the only criticism he had of the civilization was, you know, maybe humanity had gone a bit soft. Which honestly kind of mirrors the complaints we make today.
Yeah, that does sound familiar. I can think of several groups of people on Twitter that have that exact complaint.
Yeah, I was quite amused to hear it, in fact. You know, to hear him complaining, you know, civilization is so soft. Remember, we're talking about 1910s. we think of those guys as pretty much Conan.
Yeah, it's like, you know, back in the 1910s, like, I'm reading this this Howard biography, like I said, and it really, he gives a big picture of kind of Texas and the greater U.S., at the time of the writing. And, like, right when that book came out was right about when Robert E. Howard started writing, like, when his first attempts at fiction were made. And, like, California didn't exist. it went about as far as Texas, you know, like, that was some shit right there, you know, it was, like, all Indians and Mexicans and blood on the frontier. And the white people were out there trying to make their way in the world in post-Civil War South, in the Reconstructionist era. So, you know, back in that era, I mean, fucking Wyatt Earp was still alive back then. He was still alive and talking to Hollywood about making Western movies, like, so that they had the proper amount of realism and shit. So it's easy to look at that time period from especially our soyified generation now and say, well, obviously the men of this time period were greater than us. But when you've got guys who live in that time period, they're saying maybe people are going a little bit soft nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of a wake up call.
Yeah. Yeah. I just bring that up because, as I said, you know, looking at hindsight, you know, they were looking at the, you know, it's like, okay, we look at the people of Burroughs' era and Robert E. Howard's era as, you know, as basically these swaggering tough guys who always got shit done. But, yeah, you know, like I said, we think of them as basically Conan, with guns. But but then they looked back on like the Civil War era and the Reconstructionist era, and they, you know, and they were thinking pretty much the same thing. You know, it's like, you know, good, you know, they're thinking, oh, good God, we are weak. You know what I mean?
We're nothing like our ancestors that came before. Oh, God, that's such a really interesting. Oh, this makes me wish I had actually gotten my sociology degree.
Yeah. 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 No sociology degree, but I have read a bunch of stuff about sociology.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, I went to college for that shit, but that's just really a really interesting parallel that literally 100 years later, almost exactly 100 years later, we are having the exact same thoughts about our generation that people like Robert Howard and Burroughs. Yeah, Burroughs had about their generation. It's just like they didn't have like the whole soy boy thing going on back then.
Obviously, but
we have degenerated much farther since the days of Howard and Burroughs. But it's interesting how some things never really change. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, they weren't saying soy boy then, but I'm almost thinking that, you know, they were thinking of like the young men of their era as, oh, my God, those guys are pussies.
Yeah, they would never take up a gun to defend, you know, kith and kin and shit.
Yeah, yeah, and then, yeah, and I think that opinion started to kind of change around World War II when they did exactly that.
Mm.
Or rather, Japan attacked, and then we declared war on Japan, and then Germany declared war on us because of that stupid little treaty they had, and therefore, so we were fighting a two-front war, and yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, they kind of disproved that notion that they had gone soft.
Yeah, but, you know, but still, it's still interesting to see that, you know, what we think of as harder times, you know, the 1910s, when most of America wasn't even electrified. Because, see, that thing we tend to think about the 20s. We think about places like New York and Chicago that had a lot of the technological innovations. We often forget, in the 20s, much of the country didn't even have electricity.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Mark Finn brings up in this biography is, and I'm sorry, but this is just the thing that I've been reading lately, is that like Cross Plains, Texas, where Robert Howard grew up, or quote unquote grew up, they moved around a lot, but Cross Plains was like his final home kind of thing. Yeah, it wasn't until like sometime in the midpoint of the 1910s, around 1918, I think, when Cross Plains finally was electrified. It had electricity for just about everybody. So, yeah, most of America at the time did not have electricity, you know, back then. That's why you watch movies like, I want to say it was The Grapes of Wrath. And I really liked the black and white movie when I saw it as a kid, but I could not read the fucking book. But yeah, you see this very honest portrayal of Dust Bowl America in that. And most of these people ain't had fucking electricity. They ain't had, you know, air conditioners and heating systems in the winter and shit like that. It was just, it was a very rough and tumble life back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, remember during the New Deal, there was a specific program aimed at electrifying the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was called something like the Rural Electrification Initiative or something like that. It was specifically aimed at rectifying that problem. And then while we're on the subject of older times, if you look on YouTube, there's a lot of these recordings of people from, you know, of people from like 1930 and such talking about their lives. Like, for example, there was one of like elderly people from, the video was taken in like 1920 or 1930 or whatever. But then you'd have these elderly people talking about their lives and about their opinions on things. And remember, we're talking about people pushing like 80 and 90 in the 1920s. What that meant was many of them were alive during the Civil War. Yeah, in fact, one time a Confederate veteran was interviewed for a little bit. Yeah, and he said something to the effect of his general was a good man.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look this up. This sounds so interesting.
Yeah, but then, you know, you just think that, you know, so in fact, one woman, I believe, was like 100. That means you're literally talking to somebody who at the time, okay.
Like literally lived through the Civil War.
Yeah.
In like 1830 or 1829 or something.
Yeah, like that. And remember, at that time, California didn't even exist.
Yeah.
For example, you know, a lot of those western states past the Mississippi River didn't even exist yet.
Yeah, like I recently was doing some research on the Confederacy because one of my story things is about these guys that are a rogue branch of the Confederate government that still operate today to take care of like paranormal threats to the Confederacy. What was the Confederacy?
All right.
And I was like, so did Texas exist? Was Texas part of the Confederacy? And I go and look it up, and yeah, the Confederacy extended from South Carolina on the East Coast out to Texas on the West Coast, or in the Midwest. And then there was like the Indian territories and stuff like that. And like at the Civil War, shit past Texas, that was fucking Indian country. You ain't go there. White people did not fucking go there, man. You were just asking to get scalped.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, that's why the Wild West was wild.
Yeah. Like that's one of the things that he mentions in this biography is that at the time of the Civil War, Texas was fighting a war on two fronts because they were fighting the North and they were fighting the Indians and the Mexicans. The Indians weren't like an established government, but the Mexicans were trying to retake Texas.
Yeah, hence all this talk about the Alamo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Alamo happened at the same time there, but I don't think it did. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get you. I'm curious, so I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, it's that. You know, the, you know,
1836.
Okay, so a great deal earlier.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, a great deal earlier because the Civil War began in 1861.
Yeah. So Alamo wasn't quite in Texas, or wasn't quite in the Civil War, but it had repercussions that lasted on to the Civil War because you still had like Pancho Villa running around and shit like that. I might be getting my history mixed up. I'm a little bit tipsy.
I think Pancho Villa was much later, but
yeah, I think so too. No, yeah, you're right. Pancho Villa was like right before Robert Howard's writing career started, I want to say.
Yeah.
Like they were around at the same time, but they never interacted, unfortunately.
Obviously. Yeah, we were talking about early 20th century America and the like.
Yeah, but I actually wanted to bring it. Sorry, everybody, we had a little break. Not technical difficulties, but physical difficulties. Put it like that. But I kind of wanted to get back to the overall point because you said that you didn't have a whole lot longer to go. Or
no, don't worry about it. We can talk for a little more.
Okay. There was something that JD had brought up in this blog post. Here it is. Why do audiences consume fiction? That's easy. It's because it's fiction. And this seemed like a little bit of a tautology to me, but then I kept reading. It's not real. It's escapism. What better way to advertise escapism than by presenting an astonishing and fascinating place beyond the human imagination? At this point, the only dividing line is what sort of escapism the customer is looking for. This is where the original genre lines come from. This, I think, is supremely important for people in the pulp rev to understand. Because people do have their genres that they like. Like, not everybody likes mystery. Not everybody likes science fiction. Not everybody likes fantasy. But that escapism, that, you know, even with the genre blending stuff, like, a lot of people are willing to forget, like, Star Wars is the most popular science fiction story ever told.
Yes.
People don't care that the ships don't move that way. The audience consumes fiction because they want to get out of their life for an hour and a fucking half.
That's true.
And I think that's supremely important for us to understand, because when you try to stick rigidly to certain genres, you maybe that's the wrong way to phrase it. When you worry about all of the superficial stuff, when you worry about the trappings more than telling an entertaining story, then people are going to you're going to get an audience that will read that stuff. But people will also kind of like shy away from that a little bit, I think. I don't know. Maybe I'm spewing malformed opinions here.
Well, no, I think that's the general point JD was making. Yeah, you know, don't get wrapped up in the minutiae.
Yeah.
You know, worry about the story first, as we were talking about with the manga and the anime, and that and how it does that very, very well.
Right.
But here's another thing that I will point out to you that I'm sure you know that it was in the back of your head, but now I'm going to point it out to you.
Okay. Blow my fucking manga, mind, fam.
Well, manga and anime has the effect that it does on us. We have to remember, because it comes from a completely different country. So to an American, the escapism factor is that much higher. I mean, it's already escapist to a Japanese, but to an American, it's that much higher because it comes from another country. So you're not necessarily mapping your own concerns here in America onto that story.
That's interesting.
That's just me. I haven't done any kind of formal study or research on it. That's just my perception.
As if we had the tools for that kind of thing.
Exactly. That's just my perception.
But no, I think that idea has legs. Stories from other, like, there's a reason that people still read Arabian Nights, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or even stories like Howard's Hyborian Age, you know, the Conan stories. That's not on Earth. Well, it's on Earth, but it's not the Earth as we know it.
It's a fantasy world, like Middle Earth.
Right. It kind of takes us out of that, like, even something like Mass Effect. You know, you can go to Earth in Mass Effect, but there's nothing really to do there.
Yeah.
It's more concerned with all of these other places that you get to go in the galaxy. That level of wonder, that level of the unknown, it can be a useful tool for fear, like H.P. Lovecraft describes in his supernatural horror and literature, but it can also just provide that wonder, like the fish out of water syndrome.
Yeah, indeed, that's largely what it relies on. It relies on this either a new land or a new situation. Yeah, because, I mean, My Hero Academia takes place on something that's recognizably our world. It just introduces a new element.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It's basically Earth. It's just now, like, 80% of the population has superpowers. What now?
Yeah. Yeah. It essentially reverses the situation in X-Men, in which, you know, in X-Men, the majority is unpowered, whereas a small minority is powered.
Right.
But MHA flips that on its head by making the majority powered. And 20% is not.
And they also make the point of saying that, like, the 20%, like, there's none of that bullshit fucking politics. You know, like, the 20% aren't oppressed. Like, Deku finds out that he doesn't have a quirk, and he asks All Might about it. He's like, you know, can I still be a hero like you? And All Might's like, look, you probably aren't going to be able to fight villains and things like that, but, you know, you could become a policeman. You know, you could become an ambulance tech or something like that. I don't remember the examples he gave exactly, but
yeah,
like, you could still have an honorable job helping and defending people, even if you're not one of these super beings.
Yeah. That's another thing I noticed. Even though you had quirkless people, it didn't go that route of you know, making that, of making them like this oppressed class that's struggling against the man or whatever.
Yeah, and honestly, I think that's why MHA is better than X-Men.
I have some friends that would argue with you about that. But
oh, I know a lot of people that would argue with me about that, but I would rather have, like, the X-Men stories that were always interesting to me were the stories where they were fighting the Sentinels, you know, or they were fighting the, I forget the name of the group of mutants, but it's like, you know, Wolverine versus Sabretooth, or, you know, just, like, these superpowered beings fucking going at it. That was what was entertaining. That was what was fun about the X-Men. Whenever they had to go to court to like, oh yeah, okay, this is exactly what I want to read in my superhero comic books, is a bunch of guys sitting in court talking about fundamental human rights. That's what I want to read my superhero comics for.
I mean the X-Men show in the 90s had them mostly fighting superpowered threats. Or highly technological threats.
Yeah. It's just like I keep coming back to this, and I realize that I'm going to have to eventually come up with an explanation for be entertaining. But that's more entertaining. Like, people, a fist fight is always more entertaining than a conversation, in my opinion.
I'd qualify that. I'd say that a conversation can be entertaining too, based on, like, perhaps what the conflict of the thing you're watching is, or the thing you're reading, or what have you, you know.
Okay, so
like, for example, in a romance novel, like, a conversation, like, a certain type of conversation would be the equivalent of that fist fight.
Okay, a good example here. You've seen Pulp Fiction, right?
No, I have not, but explain anyway.
Okay, there's a scene in Pulp Fiction where the guys are riding and they've got their informant in the back. And one of them accidentally shoots the guy in the head. Just, they're driving down the road, boom, this guy's brains are all over the fucking car. And they go to this guy's house, who turns out to be Quentin Tarantino, because, of course, he has to throw himself into every movie he makes. They call the Wolf, and he's this guy who specializes in fixing problems like this. And he shows up, and he's just like, all right, you two chuckle fucks are going to do exactly what I tell you, because we don't have a lot of time here. We got to take care of this. This is mobster shit. You know, we have a body to get rid of. We have a car that's covered in blood that we have to fix. You know, you guys need to do what I say now. And one of the characters, Jules, I think, I cannot remember the fucking actor, and I'm kicking myself. Jules is like, yeah, you know, a please would be nice. And then the Wolf turns to Jules and he's like, I didn't come here to tell you fucking please. I didn't come here to ask nicely with a cherry on top. I came here to tell you how to fix your fucking problem. And if you got a problem with the way I fucking conduct business, then I can leave right now and you can deal with the dead guy in your fucking car the way that you want to deal with him. You know, you don't have to fucking listen to me. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, like, that kind of conversation, yeah, that can be just as stressful as a fist fight. That can be just as entertaining as a fist fight. But on the whole, I would say watching two guys beat the shit out of each other is way more entertaining than watching two guys talk to each other.
I agree. Yeah, I do see where you're going with that. I do kind of agree with what you're talking about there. There's more physicality in a fist fight, that's for sure. Yeah. But as I said, you know, I don't think that a fist fight is necessarily more interesting than a conversation.
I don't know. Maybe this is one of those opinions that I'm going to have to revise here.
You might have to. Again, as I said, it depends on what you're looking for in the particular thing you're watching or reading.
I suppose. You know, like there's plenty of times where Conan has had conversations with, you know, insert person that he's going up against here. And it's been just as entertaining as any fist fight you could read in, like, the Sailor Steve Costigan stories. So I guess this is one of those opinions that I'm going to have to take under advisement.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do see what you're driving at, you know, that you like action. You like action. I like action too.
Yeah.
I like there to be a context to the action, of course, but I like action too.
Oh, yeah, it's like just a fist fight. Like, this is one of the things that Jesse is hammering me on, and we don't disagree on this. It's that, like you said, it has to have context. So that fist fight, you can open your story with a fist fight, but there has to be a reason for the fist fight. You know, these guys have to be fighting for something, and the rest of the story will hopefully reveal that, because a story about a fist fight in and of itself isn't really all that interesting. There needs to be some context between or behind why these guys are beating each other to a pulp.
Yeah, indeed. And if you're going to open with a fist fight, one quick and dirty way you can do it is, say, a boxing match.
Yeah,
I've actually seen that done.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
Robert Howard did that all the time.
That reminds me, you have to read the Black Pulp anthology.
The Black Pulp Anthology. All right, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, it's basically pulp. It's pulp, but it's from what I can understand, it's pulp by black authors, you know, about black characters. But let me tell you, it's the opposite of what you would expect from something like this.
Yeah, because honestly, what I'm expecting, given what you told me, is like Skyboat Media's Women Destroy Horror or Women Destroy Science Fiction. This sounds like, you know, black people destroy pulp or something like that.
No. This is none of that soy boy shit. Trust me on this one.
That's good to hear.
I haven't read through all of it, but yeah. But I mean, the last one on it that I did read about this character named Dylan, that one in particular is good.
Okay. I'll look it up. I'll see if I can find it on like Amazon or something.
Yeah, it's called Black Pulp.
And
it should have like a black guy with a gun on the cover.
Okay. All right. I'll definitely look it up. And like I say, I'll drop a link in the description to anybody who wants to read that.
I haven't read all of it, but I have, yeah, but what I have read is absolutely amazing. It's stories that anyone black or not would enjoy.
I mean, coming from you, that means a lot, because you're one of these guys like me who just, you know, you don't really care about that kind of shit, but if the stories are good, then the stories are good.
Yeah, it's like that.
So speaking of things like black pulp, do you want to get into like the whole like racial component to things? Given that you're a black guy, you know, do you want to get into that, or do you want to just kind of let that lie? Because I can cut this part out of the podcast. That's no problem.
No. You don't have to cut anything. You don't have to cut anything at all. But is there something you wanted to bring up?
Well, I mean, just, okay, as a black guy who's trying to break out into, like, the science fiction and fantasy scene, when you look at what people are doing with things like black pulp, despite how good you say it is, what do you feel about that kind of stuff? Because I know, like, me looking at it as a white guy, I don't particularly have any, like, racial consciousness. I'm being forced into developing one against my will. But, you know, looking at the way things are going, it's like, well, is my, you know, it's like Christopher Warren, my partner with Dimension Bucket Media, he recently got into this altercation with this guy on Twitter, where the guy was talking about promoting women in horror, or, you know, insert genre here. And he didn't bring up, Christopher Warren didn't bring up anything about, like, women are inherently inferior or anything like that. He was just like, because I'm white and straight and a male, my stuff is inherently less worthy to be published. Like, why shouldn't we be taken under equal consideration here? So looking at a market that does things like that specifically to cater to certain sexual or racial demographics as a black guy, what's your opinion on that kind of stuff?
Well, obviously I have to give the caveat that this is my own opinion, and I wouldn't say that it's representative of black people as a whole. Yeah, I'll first give that caveat.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to say anything that you don't want to, or represent anybody that you don't feel like you represent. So,
my personal opinion on that is that I do think it's a bit corny. I mean, I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to help, you know, they're trying to help black people, you know, get a foothold in a very cutthroat industry. Yeah, the other thing you have to remember too is that a lot of this stuff that you're seeing is happening in TradPub affiliated circles. And if you know anything at all about TradPub, it's that slots are limited.
Yeah.
Very limited. So people are going to cut each other's throats to get those coveted spots.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that the racial angle is really them just trying to see what kind of advantage can they pull to get the few spots that these TradPub houses have available for them.
So you see it as more of a marketing gimmick than anything.
Yeah. I do see it as something like that. They're trying to leverage their, I see them as trying to leverage their race to get an advantage in TradPub, because in Indy, all of this is irrelevant. Yeah. In Indy, you know, either you market yourself or you don't.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've bought, you know, tons of indie books, and I don't give a fuck what the other, I don't even know what the other looks like half the time. You know, occasionally I'll meet somebody on Twitter and it's like, oh, their normal picture is their AVI. But, you know, I would say something around 70% of the time, I don't even know what the author of the book that I'm buying looks like. And that's okay, because as long as the fiction is up to snuff, then it doesn't really matter what the person looks like.
I agree there.
And maybe I'm being a little bit too egalitarian or race blind for some of the people that listen to this podcast, but I really just don't think it matters that much. Like, I don't get the focus on race. Like, I understand trying to capture a market, but if the market isn't there, then why not just advertise it as a good story? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Remember, you're talking to a guy whose novella that you're featuring there, you know, features a Japanese female teaming up with a white male.
Okay, true. You got me. I just kind of wanted to get your perspective on this, because through no fault of my own, I don't get a lot of black sci-fi and fantasy authors on the podcast a lot, and I just wanted to talk to you about it for a minute, because
that's fine. Yeah, you don't, and as I said, you don't have to cut anything out, and you don't have to cut any of it out. I'm fine with it. And to develop something I had said earlier about how I thought it was kind of corny, it's because I think of it as kind of corny because, yes, I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to help, you know, black authors, trying to help them get seen, you know, and honestly, I'm actually kind of fine with that. But It's just that, you know, but you know, there's also this tendency that if the story isn't up to snuff and people say that, you know, they would often try to tar people as racist or something.
Yeah, like you're saying that the story isn't up to snuff because the author is black.
Yeah, they'll portray it as that when the story really isn't up to snuff. Yeah, it's things like that that you know, they have to be cognizant of. They're not just writing for one. You know, when you're writing these, it's not just that one type of people that's going to be reading it.
Yeah. It's like this book isn't just going to be read by black people.
For example, yeah. For example, yes, you may be marketing to that group, but
and you have to take into account demographics, and not just like racial demographics, but like racial demographics. Black people are like 14% of the U.S. population at a rough estimate.
That's true.
How many of those people read sci-fi fantasy horror? Like you're talking about an extremely small market share, given what I know, my experiences with black people. It's just not a huge market.
I would agree there. You know, I would agree there. You're looking at the population as a whole, then you're looking at people who read.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to get more black people to read. That's
I agree. I completely agree. Yeah.
I 100% support that. You know, as far as I'm concerned, everybody needs to read more. But you know, trying to market specifically.
Yeah, there's just a small conflict there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just a small conflict of interest there for both of us, but continue.
Yeah, but it, like trying to market specifically to the percentage of the 14% of the population that reads this kind of stuff is just limiting yourself so much. And I don't understand, like, I shouldn't lie. I do understand why they do it. It's because they're all in the cult of social justice. But, like, you could reach so many more people if you just made your stories universal.
I would agree there. And that also is a good way to lead into this topic as well. Sensitivity readers.
Oh, now, Lord. Okay.
Okay. Now, if you've seen me on Twitter and such, I would often disparage the idea of sensitivity readers because of all these blow-ups about Kira Drake's book, you know, and about...
Oh,
and
that, was about the witch in the woods, wasn't it?
No. Kira Drake's book was called The Continent, and that was the one where she had that tribe of people... You know, that seemed kind of too Indian-ish, so she had to rewrite them to make them white.
Okay, no, I must have missed this one.
Yeah, no. Laurie Forrest wrote The Black Witch,
that was the book that I was thinking
of. Yeah, which is about the, you know, about the magician girl that learns not to be racist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read it either. I'm just going by the summaries people give.
Yeah.
And also another book called American Heart. I forget who it's by. Yeah, Laura Moriarty, yes. American Heart, which is about, you know, Muslims start getting locked up in, like, internment camps. And this white girl learns to empathize with them because she's been told all her life that, you know, the Muslims are dangerous. You see, again, about sensitivity readers. Now, I honestly think that... The concept that the sensitivity reader thing is actually sort of a good idea. Let me qualify that.
Okay. No, I agree with you, but probably for different reasons than you're going to bring up. So go ahead.
Yeah. Again, let me qualify that. You see, when you're writing about a cultural background or something that you don't know much about, it is a good idea to seek out someone from that background, you know, or who lives that life or whatever, to look over your stuff to see if you've got the feel right, to see if you've gotten it right.
Yeah.
It is a good idea to do that. I had not done that with Sword and Flower, But yeah, but I'm saying in general, it's a good, if you're able to do it, it's a good idea to do it.
Yeah, you know, I can see that. Yeah. Like getting somebody to beta read your stuff. Like if I was writing a story about, I don't know, English people in Britain, whatever the premise of the story might be. I have a friend that lived in Britain. He was born in Britain. I would send the story to him and be like, hey, does this, you know, does this come close enough to be serviceable?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It can be useful to get somebody to give you a insider's perspective on your writing, especially if you're an outsider. But I sense that you have something else to say about the sensitivity readers.
Yeah, of course. That's what I said. In that respect, the sensitivity reader idea, you know, is good. It's like you would get any other subject matter expert when say talking about history or talking about a certain profession or whatever.
Right.
You know, you have them look it over to see if you got some stuff right. Of course, you're gonna take a little artistic license, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you want to get the feel right. The problem is that the SJWs took this otherwise very good idea, and poisoned it with their political agenda. It wasn't about trying to make, you know, your characters authentic or feel good, you know, or have the right feel. It was about signaling how woke you were.
Right.
And if you didn't use sensitivity readers, you were racist. the discourse around such readers became very poisoned. So it turned a lot of people off, including myself, to even the idea of sensitivity readers or having people, you know, from that culture look it up because you're getting the impression from the SJWs that they're policing your work.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's not all that difficult in the information age that we live in to just do a little bit of research on the internet and find out what's up with that particular lifestyle.
Yes, there's that too. But, you know, sometimes there are certain things you can't just get that you simply cannot get from reading books or reading websites or looking at YouTube videos.
That's true.
Yeah. And as I said, it's good to have people who are experts in that look it over. So, yeah, it's good to have people who are experts look it over. And that's a very good idea. That's an idea I don't disagree with at all. But, yeah. The problem was that, you know, it became poisoned with politics and then the whole thing got a bad rap.
So are you arguing for sensitivity readers here? I'm just trying to like get an idea of what you're driving at here. Okay, we are back. Sorry about that, everybody. I had a slight flub with my internet that interrupted the Skype call, but so are you arguing for sensitivity readers here?
Well, I'm arguing not so much for sensitivity readers as subject matter experts.
Okay.
I prefer to view it in those terms. Just as you would get somebody if you were writing about the modern military, for example, you would get someone, you know, who's been like a veteran to read your stuff to kind of see if you've gotten the feel right, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and just on that same token, if you're writing about some historical period, you know, you want to run it by somebody who studied that period.
Or at least go and study that period yourself.
That too. You know, yeah, that too. You know, the point is, you know, you do your research and you talk to subject matter experts. And by the same token, you know, if you're writing about a contemporary, currently existing way of life or culture that you don't know much about, it is a good idea to run it by somebody who's lived that life or who knows that life very intimately.
I can understand where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, that's what I'm arguing for. I'm arguing more in terms of subject matter experts. But of course, what I'm arguing against is, you know, using this as a means of policing somebody's work. Yeah, right. The point is, whoever you're asking, you know, shouldn't try to hijack your work. Shouldn't try to, you know, kind of tell you what to write or whatever, or use it as some kind of leverage against you.
Yeah, or try to, you know, ruin your reputation on social media or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, basic stuff like that. But you see, that's my take on the sensitivity reader phenomenon.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It's one of those, I don't know. It's one of those things that I don't think ever should have come in. Like, there's a long and storied tradition of, you know, I'm writing this story set in 1850s Texas or something like that. So I'm going to run it by a historian, you know, see if I can get them to review my work. Or I'm going to go and study 1850s Texas and make sure that I've got my shit straight. But the whole sensitivity readers thing, it just struck me as fundamentally, at base, a method of control. You know, it was, if this and also to root out dissenters. Like, if somebody turns in a manuscript that isn't up to snuff so far as these sensitivity readers are concerned, then, oh, we have another witch to burn, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like, I absolutely do not support its use as a tool of, you know, as a tool of political control, as a tool of deciding who, you know, who is the most woke. I absolutely do not support its use in that regard. But, you know, but I do support the idea of running these things through people who have lived that life.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as they respect that, you know, it's your story, and that, you know, you're going to tell what you're going to tell.
Honestly, this is why I work in fantasy and sci-fi as much as I do, because you don't really have that, you know, you don't really have that concern. You don't have to worry about how accurate your portrayals of whatever people are.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean that's a big convenience right there.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to touch on while we're here?
I think I'm pretty much tuckered out at this point.
Yeah, I'm about tapped for subjects too. So all right, we'll go ahead and call it here. But it was a good discussion, and I appreciate you coming on the show, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead and let everybody know where they can find you before we sign off here.
Yeah. I'm Rolnianzi. You can find me at rolnianzi.com.
Give him a quick spelling, because that's an unusual name.
Yeah, of course. That's RAWLENYANZI.com, all one word. And you can also find me on Twitter as RAWLENYANZIFTL. That's RAWLE. NYANZIFTL.
Don't you have a gab too, I think?
No, I do not have a gab.
You need to get on that, fam. But okay, yeah, there will be links. Is there anything else you want me to link down in the description for you, apart from your website and your Twitter?
Of course, link Sword and Flower.
Yeah, the Sword and Flower, of course.
And that At the Earth's Core review that you said.
Yeah, of course. Right. So, yeah, you guys can find Rolnianzi on Twitter and at his website, which, once again, will be linked down in the description. So everybody go and follow Rol on Twitter and check out his website for kick-ass book reviews, and go and read his book Sword and Flower, which is up on Amazon. Rol, thanks again for coming on the show, man. It has been a fucking blast talking to you. We're going to have to do this again sometime.
Of course, yeah. Thank you for talking to me. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, I hope to do this again sometime too.
All right, well, we will see you all next week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Y'all have a good weekend. Peace out. All right. Thank you very much for listening, first off. And thank you to Rolnianzi again for coming on. All of his links will be down below, including that review that he talked about in the podcast. So go and check out his website, add it to your feed reader, and follow him on Twitter, and when he gets a gab, follow him on Gab too. and be sure to buy his novella Sword and Flower. But it has come to the point in the podcast where I will do the sponsors and then get out of everybody's hair. So we've got a couple of new entries here. First off, I have been featured in Kirsova magazine, and it is pretty mind-blowing. It still doesn't feel real, even as I look at my contributor's copy that I was sent that's, you know, all physical and wood pulp paper and everything like that. It doesn't feel real, but I do have a story in the new Kirsova number 8, and there will be a link down in the description where you can go to Amazon and pick that up. And another story of mine has also been featured in the Planetary Earth anthology from Superversive Press. Once again, there will be a link in the description to where you guys can go and grab that. It's me and a bunch of other people. I think there's something like 18 stories in this anthology. And by the time this podcast goes live, it should be up on Amazon for everybody to go and buy. So be sure and check that one out, fam-a-lam. But let's get into the more traditional sponsors here. So if you like what I do here, you like the discussions and the podcast and the fiction and the blog posts and things like that, and you want to support me, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. Now, I do have a Maker Support up. You can go over there and check that out. Maker Support has been engaged in some not exactly shady business practices lately, but if you trust Maker Support and you want to try and support me through that, then that is available. I also have a Ko-fi. Which you can find the link on my website on the left-hand side of the page, where you can just toss me a tip if you like what I do. Just a couple of bucks, couple of shekels in the hat, I would be most appreciative. I also have Up the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks. So if you are into good superversive military science fiction with strong female character, then you can't do better than the Cat Kimbridge Chronicles. These are some of the best military science fiction that I've read in my life, because it's purely built to entertain, not push any kind of political message. I've done books 6, 7, and 8 in the series, and those are all up on Audible. So if you want to help me out, I do get royalties off of those books, and I cannot recommend Andrew Beery's work enough. It is excellent science fiction. Next up, we have the Dimension Bucket Media Books. So we have Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is a collection of microfiction by Hell Richards, in which none of them will take you longer than 5 minutes to read. So if you're into some good, spooky short fiction, then go and check that one out. Next up, we have Dimension of Cobwebs, which is a collection of weird fiction from grandmasters of the craft. So people like H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, Frank Belknap Long, Hans Heinz Ewers, and a couple of other people. H.G. Wells, I know, is in that one as well. So if you want to find out where weird fiction came from, then you cannot do better than this anthology. Darkest of Dreams is an anthology of horror stories from the Dimension Bucket Media crew. That's myself, Christopher Warren, a.k.a. Dimension Bucket, Connor Goff, a.k.a. Nightshade, and William Harmer, a.k.a. Gentleman Walrus. So if you want to find out how the Dimension Bucket Media crew perceives and presents horror fiction, then this might be a good place to start. A Man Upstairs is a collection of creepy verse by Christopher Warren, who is neither a poet nor does he like freeform poetry, so of course he had to go and write a book of it. And it's actually very good, shockingly enough, especially coming from somebody like me who just doesn't like poetry in general. Cracked, C-R-A-C-K-apostrophe-D, is a novella by Connor Goff about a man who discovers a horrible secret behind reality, and reality starts fracturing around him, and he has to figure out what's going on before he just goes crazy. Phoenix on the Sword is the first published Conan story. Conan is king of Aquilonia, and he has to deal with people trying to assassinate and depose him and install a puppet government in his stead. And there's also a subplot with a Stygian warlock who has summoned a baboon demon that Conan has to go on a dream quest under a mountain to get a magic sword to be able to defeat, and it's just primo sword and sorcery. This is the origin of sword and sorcery. Next up, we have Aaron Clary. Aaron is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com and has a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com. So if you are looking for the answers to life questions, barring medical and legal advice, then Aaron is the guy that you want to go to, because he will give you the straight dope, no bullshit. So if you have questions about life, the universe, and everything, then I would turn you to Aaron first, because he's been there, and he's fucked up, and he's learned enough from it to tell you how not to fuck yourself up. He also has several books out, a few of which I've done the audiobooks for. Most recently, I did Poor Richard's Retirement, which is about how you can achieve fiscally feasible retirement in today's economic environment. I've also done Enjoy the Decline, Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States. And if you are worried about the way that the country is going, which honestly you probably should be, this book will help you adjust your mindset and realize what you can control and what you can't control, and then take care of the things that you can control and let go of what you can't control so that you are fully able to enjoy the decline. I've also done Reconnaissance Man, which is about how you should not just leap out of high school into college. You should take some time and figure out what you want to do and where you want to do it and how profitable what you want to do is. And if that's not profitable, then pick something that is. This book is more for the younger set, but older people can get plenty of good information out of it too. And Aaron's books are highly recommended. He also has Curse of the High IQ. So if you don't think that you're a dummy, if you think that you might be smarter than the average bear, but you can't understand why the world moves so slowly, why everything is at the pace of the normie, then this is the book for you. It will explain what is wrong and how you can personally take steps to fix it in your own private life. Because God knows the world isn't going to change for you. Next up, we have Johnny Boyle, who's written the excellent novel Queen's Air. That's H-E-I-R, the heir to the queen, not the air that the queen breathes. It is a sword and sorcery fantasy novel set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age, and it has everything that you could possibly hope for in a sword and sorcery novel. It has high seas adventure, it has good old-fashioned sword fights, it has fantastical races, most of which he came up with on his own. It has dragons, ghosts, werewolves, demons. Everything that you could possibly imagine is in this book, and it is well, well worth the read, fam. I'm just saying. And you can find links to all of these on my blog, jimfear138.blogspot.com. Next up, we have the affiliate accounts. The way the affiliate accounts work is you click the link, you go to the website, you buy what you want to buy. It doesn't cost you anymore. It doesn't cost the seller anymore. But the website themselves give me a kickback out of their profits for sending you over there. So first up, we have Amazon.com. So if you want to go and buy some of these awesome books that I'm telling you about or that Raul recommended to you, then you can just click on my Amazon affiliate link and go over to Amazon and get that shit in your Kindle. Next up, we have MyComicShop.com, which is your one-stop shop for all things comic books. So if you're looking for older things, you want to get some Marvel comics, but you don't want to give the company any money, you want to get into retro comics, this is where you need to go. This is where I get all of my wildly obscure comic books from. And I cannot recommend this site enough. I've never had a problem with them. Comics have never arrived damaged. They are always well protected and they always arrive on time. You cannot find a better service on the internet for comic books. Next up, we have RightStuffAnime.com, and this is basically MyComicShop.com for weebs. So if you are into anime and manga, this is where you need to go to get your fix. They are set up with all of the distributors and the localizers and everything like that, so the money goes exactly where you mean it to go, meaning people get paid when you buy from RightStuffAnime.com. They have anime, manga, DVD and Blu-ray. They also have clothes like jackets, hats, they have body pillows, Nendoroid figurines, the Gundam figurines, just about anything that you can think of. It's very rare that I go to Right Stuff Anime looking for something and they don't have it. Same with MyComicShop.com. Next up, we have ads on the blog. So if you would like to advertise on the blog, then all you gotta do is get in touch using the contact form on the left-hand side of the blog. And for $20 a month, you get an advertisement on the blog right up at the top where everybody can see it as soon as they come onto the page. You will also get a post on the blog advertising your thing, as well as posts on all of my social media accounts. So Twitter, Tumblr, Gab, Minds, and I think there's a couple of others in there. I'm also willing to do audio and video advertisements for your thing that I can put up on BitChute or YouTube, and you can put up wherever you like. So if you have a YouTube channel or if you have a blog that you want to put an audio advertisement for your thing on, then just get in touch and I would be more than willing to work that out with you. Lastly, we have the Bandcamp. The Bandcamp is where I'm putting my independent audio narrations. It's kind of sparse right now, but watch that space. As soon as I have some time freed up, I'm going to be doing some more stuff for that. So just keep that in mind. But yeah, that's the end of the sponsor roll. I'm sorry it's a little short. I've been drinking a little tonight, I'm not gonna lie. But I hope that you guys enjoyed the podcast, and I hope that you checked out the sponsors, and I hope that you will also check out all of Rawl's links down in the description. I'd like to thank Rawl again for coming on the show. It was an excellent conversation, and I look forward to having him on the show again. And I look forward to you guys listening again. Thank you all very much, and I will catch you all next week. Peace out, everybody.